is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, August 23rd, 2024. I'm your host, Breanne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. This week on Rabble Radio, Rabble editor Nick Seabrook sits down with Joyce Arthur to talk about belief-based denial of care and the state of abortion rights in Canada. Joyce Arthur is the founder and executive director of the Abortion Rights Coalition of Canada. The Abortion Rights Coalition of Canada is a broad-based national feminist organization consisting of groups and individuals who undertake political and educational work on reproductive rights and health issues. Here is Nick Seabrook's conversation with Joyce Arthur. Take a listen.
Joyce, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Nick.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and Abortion Rights Coalition of Canada.
Well, I've been involved in the pro-choice movement for a long time. I guess you can call me a veteran. So since around 1988, and I worked for many years with the BC Coalition for Abortion Clinics here in BC. I'm based in Vancouver. And then ended up kind of leading that group. It turned into the Pro-Choice Action Network. And I was looking around the country and thought, well, there's a lot more work that needs to be done nationally. So I thought, let's take this national. And I ended up founding a whole new group, which was Abortion Rights Coalition of Canada. And that was in 2005 that we launched. So we're coming up to our 20th anniversary next year. So it's gone very well, I think. We're, I think, a pretty strong group in terms of the weight that we throw around on the political stage in Canada. And what ARC does is we're a grassroots political advocacy group. We're not a charity, so we do things like lobbying. We fight against the anti-choice member bills and motions in Parliament, the private member bills. And they've all been defeated. And I think our work has made a difference in mobilizing the pro-choice movement against those bills. And just trying to just keeping an eye, scrutinizing the political horizon for any threats and fighting against them. And we do a lot of work also countering anti-choice initiatives like the crisis pregnancy centers that counsel people against abortion and stopping their funding and things like that. So a lot of the political work, but we do educational work as well. We have workshops, activist workshops, and various other campaigns. We'll do petitions and you name it. We'll try and do whatever's needed to protect abortion rights, legal rights, and also improve access.
Wonderful. And part of that is that you also share the occasional op-ed that you'll find on rabble.ca, just talking a little bit more in depth about some of these issues. And we had one go up on our website the week of August the 14th. So tell us a little bit about that op-ed. It was about belief-based denial of care. Can you tell us about what that is?
Sure. People might be more familiar with the term conscientious objection, which is what it's normally called. And that's kind of a global term that's taken hold. That's been around since the 1960s, starting in the United Kingdom. And what it means is that doctors who personally object for religious reasons or whatever to abortion or contraception, or these days it could be medical assistance in dying, but very rarely other procedures, sometimes like organ donation, things like that. But it's these so-called contentious procedures that doctors or other healthcare workers disagree with. So they refuse to do them. And so various countries, about 70 countries in the world, have laws or regulations that allow some degree of this practice. But it doesn't work very well in terms of doctors won't refer appropriately. They won't even provide emergency care for people needing abortion. And basically, I was looking at this whole issue, and I've been working on this issue for years, especially with a colleague of mine in Europe. His name is Dr. Christian Fiala. And I didn't like the term conscientious objection, not just because it's hard to say fast, but because it's not conscientious. We feel that, you know, if you're going to become a doctor, if you're going to go into obstetrics, gynecology, or even family practice, you're going to encounter people with unwanted pregnancies, people who need an abortion, people who need contraception. And this is your job, basically. You're in part of a regulated profession. You should be providing these services to people. You know, the very, very least, you should be referring appropriately. That's kind of like the compromise position. But often this doesn't happen. And I'm really concerned about Canada, because here we have Canada is in in an enviable position in many ways because we have no abortion law. You know, we need to improve access, of course, but it's often very good in major cities. But pretty much every province, well, every province allows doctors to refuse to provide care. So we've renamed it. Sorry, I should circle back here. We've renamed it belief-based care denial. And what that term means, it kind of points out the that it is based on ideological beliefs, not on like clinical considerations or medical things. And it kind of points out the contradiction between here's doctors elevating their own personal interests above patient needs and interests, even though they have to take an oath and they're supposed to abide by regulations and ethical codes that do put the patient first. Mm-hmm. So they really need to leave their personal beliefs by the door. I mean, I think that the time to exercise their so-called conscientious objection is before they enter a particular field in medicine. You know, like if you can't provide abortions, then become a proctologist, you know? So it seems pretty obvious to me and hopefully to many other people. But this is something that we've been fighting against for years because oddly enough, even though when you tell the public about this kind of thing or other advocates, they say, of course, you know, doctors should be required to provide these services. And if they can't do it, they should get another job or whatever. But among the medical profession itself, there's quite a bit of protectionism amongst doctors, even amongst pro-choice doctors who support belief-based care denial. So that's kind of what we're up against. And we always have to fight against these objections like, well, you can't force doctors to do abortions. But that's not what it's about. It's not about forcing doctors to do anything. It's about creating disincentives for them to, you know, stop in their field or move to a different field or join another field.
Well, and just on that, so how do you sort of counter some of those arguments about, well, you know, does it violate a doctor's right to religious freedom if it's against his religion to, say, provide an abortion?
You might say that it does to a certain extent, but in Canada, we have a bunch of different rights and no one right is more important than the other. Mm-hmm. And when rights conflict, then there's a balancing exercise that takes place. There was a court case in Ontario a few years ago where some Christian medical groups and doctors sued the Ontario College of Physicians and Surgeons because they didn't want to have to refer for abortion or medical assistance in dying. They lost the case. And I believe, I can't remember the details, but it's quite possible the court said, well, yes, maybe it is an infringement of the doctor's, you know, personal beliefs or whatever. But in this particular case, we have vulnerable patients whose health is at stake, who might not be able to get the service otherwise. So their interests are paramount in this case. And doctors have taken this oath to help patients. So that's more important. And doctors are required to refer.
Right. And you mentioned that all provinces do allow some level of belief-based denial of care. How often, though, do you see doctors exercising that choice to deny care to someone who needs it?
That's a good question. It's very hard to tell because you don't often hear these stories. Sometimes they come up in the media where you know, a patient will maybe go to the media or complain that the doctor refused a contraception or whatever. So we don't have a lot of stories, but there are definitely are some. And the difficulty is that the only recourse a patient has if they're refused service or a referral is complaining to their provincial college of physicians and surgeons. It's a barrier, and the college doesn't really pay much attention. There's not really much discipline that's happening around these kinds of cases. So it's a bit of a hopeless scenario. And only Nova Scotia and Ontario, I should mention, actually require doctors who object to give an effective referral, in other words, to someone else who can provide the service. Otherwise, doctors don't have to do anything. They don't have to refer at all. So it's really a bad situation. So what we've actually done, ARC has partnered with the University of Ottawa. There's a research team there. We're looking at a couple of studies. One is just wrapping up, but looking at the impacts on patients who are denied services. And so we recruited and looked for people who had experienced that, and we ended up with about 40 people that we interviewed. And a lot of them were like refusals of sterilization, because, you know, often a younger woman who's decided she doesn't want to have children, she's going to get a pushback from her doctor. Oh, you might change your mind, and this and that, kind of paternalizing treatment, but also refusals of abortion and contraception. And so that study is coming out soon. And we do have a scoping review that's being published in September, but the interview article as well is coming out. One thing I found interesting about the study is that all of the participants, all 40 or 42, however many there were, all agreed 100% that doctors should not have this so-called right to refuse services or refuse referrals. So I thought that was interesting because here again, we have an overwhelming opposition to this practice, you know, across the board, you know, except amongst doctors themselves and the colleges, you know, the powers that be, so to speak. So that's kind of the issue that we're trying to change. And we're trying to like, we're not speaking to the anti-choice movement trying to change their mind. We're speaking to the establishment, to the medical groups, to other doctors who and trying to convince them to oppose this practice and, you know, try it. And the goal is to try and phase it out gradually over time so we have fewer and fewer objectors.
So is that the strategy for a solution is to go to the medical associations? Is it on the provinces? Is it on the federal government to legislate?
It really is up to the colleges of physicians and surgeons because it's not a legalized environment. Mm. It's policies. And as I mentioned, like Ontario and the Nova Scotia colleges have policies that require effective referral. And I think, you know, at the very least, you know, I would like to see it all gone. But, you know, I've written lots of letters to different colleges and they don't really listen to me. So it's frustrating, but at least that it should be required to refer. You know, that's the accommodation of their religious beliefs. But my demands of the colleges have been like, let's implement monitoring and enforcement services because they don't even have that. In that lawsuit that I mentioned briefly in Ontario a few years ago, the college actually used as a defense that they didn't do any monitoring enforcement of the policy. So it didn't really have any impact anyway on the doctor. So they didn't have any grounds to sue. So I'm thinking, what? So I think that's crazy. I think if you're going to have a policy requiring referral, you need to have some teeth behind it. And the enforcement could take the form of, for example, you know, making a list of the refusers, the care deniers, so that we know who they are, requiring objectors to file a report every time they do a refusal, you know, just in the monitoring them. Also at the hiring point, like especially for hospitals or clinics, if they're hiring a doctor, they can give priority to doctors who are not going to be care deniers. Or if they do hire a care denier, they can pay them less. You know, all these kinds of disincentives that they can do. And for the colleges, they could make it a lot easier for patients to complain, put more teeth behind the discipline so that it's not just a little, you know, rap on the knuckles. Or like in one case, a doctor had to put up a sign in their waiting room that they don't provide contraception. But really, there's no punishment. And I think it should be seen in a more harsher light because this really does harm patients. It can delay them from seeking care. It could even deprive them of care entirely if they don't have a family doctor, if they have a hard time getting to a doctor or whatever, it can have quite serious consequences.
Absolutely. And I think this is a good opportunity to sort of expand the conversation that we're having, because this summer is the 2-year anniversary of the overturning of Roe v. Wade in the United States, a landmark court case that guaranteed the right to abortion for almost 50 years in that country. And you mentioned at the top of our conversation, there is no law restricting access to abortion in Canada. So some listeners might be surprised that there are barriers, and they might not think that something like that could happen here, where it becomes a restricted right. So could you talk about that a little bit, Joyce, about are there threats to access to abortion? We just talked about one, but are there others? Are there people trying to claw back access?
Well, currently, I mean, we have a liberal government, so that's good in the sense that they're you know, a pro-choice government, and they're not trying to restrict access in any way. They talk a good game at improving access. Some of the steps they could take could be better. But the main fear that we have is here we are almost in the fall of 2024, and next year we're expecting a new federal election. And Pierre Poilievre and the Conservative Party are ahead in the polls. So we're really worried about what the Conservative Party, if they get into government, what they can do for abortion, against abortion rights. And I mean, currently, the main fear is just things like private member bills being introduced. There was one last year by a Conservative MP, but it was defeated. But, you know, the fact that they keep doing this over and over again is worrisome and points to their determination to keep after this issue. Like, you know, we can never rest. We can never rest on our laurels. We can't be apathetic about our rights. They're always going to be in danger. We saw that in the U.S. when Roe v. Wade was overturned. Like, oh, my God, like rights can be endangered. And you mentioned there's kind of two sides of it. Some people say, oh, we're okay in Canada. We don't have a law and things are safe. But other people at the time were saying, oh, my God, this could happen here in Canada. We're in trouble. What should we do? So I saw both sides of it. And so it's kind of a in the middle there, because yes, legally our rights here are very safe. You know, they're actually charter protected. Like when the Supreme Court struck down the abortion law in 1988, it was on the basis of bodily security rights, which is in the charter. And so that's very strong. And another of the judges mentioned the right to conscience and life and liberty. So, and there's been lots of precedents since then that have upheld the right to abortion consistently. And the charter is kind of the jurisprudence of the charter is stronger. That Morgenthaler decision from 1988 that struck down the abortion law is one of the cornerstones of human rights jurisprudence in Canada today. So I say it's very strong legally. So I'm not worried about laws, and I don't think even Pierre Poilievre and his conservative government would try and pass laws, because that would just be so unpopular and attract so much negative attention that I don't think they would go there. But there's so many other things they could do, and the problems we have in Canada are around access. So as I mentioned, access in some of the major cities is actually excellent, you know, Vancouver, Montreal, Toronto. But you get outside the cities and it can plummet quite substantially to almost nothing in some places. And we're talking about, you know, any rural area, conservative regions, like the Maritimes up north, that people might have to travel a long ways for abortion, or they're just living in a very small conservative community. They don't know where to go. You know, people don't have the information that they need. So there's that urban-rural divide that we have to tackle. And I think the abortion pill, Nifegimiso in Canada, has helped a lot. And ironically, it was a pandemic that kind of really boosted the use of telemedicine and Nifegimiso. So it's helped a lot in the smaller communities and rural areas where people can just have, say, a video call with their doctor, a doctor maybe in Vancouver, and then go pick up the prescription from the local pharmacy. And so that's helping a lot, and it's getting better and better over time. More and more doctors are prescribing it. So I'm very confident and happy about that. Still, there's gaps and you know, barriers and things we need to keep improving. That'll never stop. And we always still need the aspiration or surgical abortion as well, like after 12 weeks as a follow-up, or when people are too late for the pill, because it can only be taken up to 9 weeks in Canada. And so there's issues like that. And then what I'm worried about in terms of Poilievre and the Conservatives, if they get in, is that one thing, there's a lot of funding that's been going into sexual and reproductive health in Canada. Some groups like Action Canada for Sexual Health and Rights, it's another national abortion rights group. And then the National Abortion Federation Canada, which is a professional association for doctors, and they do lots of training and things like that. They received some funding in the millions, tens of millions of dollars from the Liberal government after Roe v. Wade was overturned, which is fantastic. The only problem is that funding is time limited, so it runs out in a few years, and really it needs to be made permanent, because you know, sexual reproductive health are not needs that end in, you know, 3 or 5 years, right? We need it forever. And also, we've been funding for quite some years now maternal health and safe abortion in developing countries like in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
We're saving lives over there. And I could foresee, you know, quite easily with a stroke of the pen, as soon as Poilievre gets to be prime minister, that funding is gone.
You know, you mentioned that you don't think that they would put out explicit legislation opposing abortion. But I think that sort of is a really good way to define the difference between the fight in the U.S. and the fight in Canada, where the fight in the U.S., the conservatives, the evangelicals, they're very explicit about wanting to ban abortion. In Canada, the conservatives do it in more of a, you know, by the back door kind of a way of things that sound relatively innocuous. Like I think last year, the bill that they tried to pass was about harsher penalties for people who are pregnant, who are attacked, who are assaulted, which for the first time would provide rights for the unborn through a byway through that law. So do you kind of see it that way, that in Canada it's more of a, you know, a sort of a innocuous things like that, where they kind of try to just wedge open the door a little bit to block access?
Yes, exactly. You've hit the nail on the head. I think when we look at the states, it's so really the extremists are in charge there, you know, in the Republican Party. They can get away with all this BS and be open about what they're trying to do, even though it's really unpopular. And here in Canada, they have to be much, much more careful. And I think that's a combination of things, just our system. We're a more secular society. People are less religious here. But also in the past, when, you know, going back, you know, 20 years or more, when anti-choice politicians would speak up in the media, like say during an election campaign, they would just get attacked by the media, and it would be a really, really bad look. And there's been times in the past as well where candidates or elected officials have had to resign or apologize for saying something really awful, anti-choice or anti-gay or whatever. So it doesn't just fly well here in Canada at all. So they have to be really careful in their language. We see that across the board in the anti-choice movement. They're kind of a much meeker, milder version of the U.S. movement. And they even will co-opt feminist language sometimes because the private members' bills, for example, like the one you pointed out, it's about helping pregnant women, right? We're for women's rights, and they also want to ban sex selection abortion because, oh, we're against gender discrimination against women. And so they paint their motives as being feminist and pro-woman, but really it's about, as you say, underhanded ways to get in fetal personhood for embryos and zygotes and so on. And another popular bill they've had in the past a couple of times is trying to, when a pregnant woman is attacked in a crime, if the fetus is hurt or killed, then it becomes two separate crimes. And then so that gives a kind of a personhood to the fetus as a victim of crime. So that's another way that they've tried and failed in the past. So that's why we feel it's very important to fight against these motions and bills and also just kind of educate the public on what it really means, you know, when the anti-choice are saying these things. And another thing that's very interesting along these lines is when the Liberal government, the party, promised in their 2019 campaign to no longer give charitable tax status to anti-choice groups. And this is a promise we've been trying to keep them to, and hopefully it still might happen, fingers crossed. But right away, the anti-choice movement got really worried. And I did learn that many groups have been doing a lot of work in sort of cleaning up their websites and their public-facing materials to make it look like they're not anti-choice in any way, because they're so afraid of losing the charitable tax status. And you go on some of these sites and they look really slick and you can't even tell what their stance is on abortion. They seem so nice. And so it is very worrisome. And we have to spend a lot of time like pointing out how you can identify like a crisis pregnancy center on the website. You know, what are the words and slogans to look for?
And we're just coming up on the end of the interview. We just have a few minutes left. But before we go, Joyce, do you have anything you want to share with our audience that maybe I didn't ask, or maybe something to let them know how to get involved if they're interested in wanting to help protect access and rights to abortion?
Yeah, there's so much that people can do. We have a Take Action page on our website that people can check out, our Abortion Rights Coalition of Canada. But just, you know, talking about abortion, I think, is really important, keeping it out in the public eye and overcoming the shame and stigma around abortion. So write emails and letters, articles, share your abortion story if you've had an abortion. One in three Canadian people who are capable of pregnancy will have had an abortion at some point in their lives. Refute anti-choice propaganda and misinformation. And know your own rights, like know what the law is, the facts, learn how to access abortion in your own community. Because even if you don't need it yourself someday, maybe you can help a friend or a family member and supporting others who need abortion. Organize or participate, at least, in reproductive rights campaigns or go to events. Keep in touch with your MP, your member of parliament, and also your provincial elected representative. Get on their mailing list, and then you can, you know, ask them to fight for abortion rights or whatever is going on in your province. Support your local clinics and providers. And of course, you can join a reproductive rights group or volunteer or donate to them.
Joyce Arthur of Abortion Rights Coalition of Canada, thank you so much for joining me today on Rabble Radio.
Thank you.
That was Joyce Arthur from the Abortion Rights Coalition of Canada and Rabble editor Nick Seabrook in conversation. Thank you so much, Nick and Joyce. Switching gears now, let's review the top stories on Rabble.ca in a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. And for that, let's turn things back over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Back to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week in labor news, Canada's railway freight system is at a standstill at time of recording, as the country's two largest rail freight companies have locked out their unionized workers. This is the first time in history that both the Canadian National Railway Company, known as CN Rail, and Canadian Pacific Kansas City Limited have suspended their operations. For months, both companies have been in negotiations with the Teamsters Canada Rail Conference, but no agreement had been reached by the Thursday at midnight lockout deadline. The union has been fighting both companies to protect their members' rights to adequate sleep and from being relocated for extended periods away from their families. Both CN Rail and Canadian Pacific Kansas City Limited have insisted on reducing time allotted for their employees to sleep, saying that there is no risk to workplace safety in doing so. The Teamsters Canada Rail Conference represents more than 9,000 engineers, conductors, and yard workers who are now on the picket lines, leaving Canada's freight and commuter rail systems at a standstill. In economic news, in an exclusive op-ed for Rabble.ca, economist Jim Stanford breaks down the inaccuracies and lies that the Federal Conservative Party is promoting about wages and inflation. Whether through using old data, creative rounding of numbers, or just flat-out inaccurate interpretations of statistics, the Conservatives are trying to paint an economic picture that fits their narrative. In fact, real wages for Canadians are beginning to recover from the pandemic. And as COVID-19-related inflation eases, the purchasing power of Canadians is growing with that as well. Much like the Conservatives' recent Made in Canada video, which featured many clips that originated in other countries, their economic data also doesn't hold up to close scrutiny. And finally, in education news, a new report from the Nova Scotia School Board Council of Unions shows that violence in schools is on the rise and that educational support workers often bear the brunt of it. Educational support workers include teaching assistants, custodians, early childhood educators, and more. A separate report by the Nova Scotia Auditor General shows that daily incidents of violence in Nova Scotia public schools have increased by 60% in the last 7 years. At the South Shore Regional Center for Education in Bridgewater, Nova Scotia, 81% of violent incidents were reported by school support staff. One school support worker quoted in the report shared that they had been bitten, kicked, slapped, punched, spat on, and worse in the last 7 years of their career. The Nova Scotia School Board Council of Unions is calling on the government to act to better protect workers in schools. As always, you can read all the stories we talked about today on Rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. The last thing we'll leave you with, listeners, is this. Rabble.ca and the Institute for Change Leaders are proud to announce that we are now accepting applications for the 7th Annual Jack Layton Journalism for Change Fellowship. To learn more about this fantastic opportunity, please visit Rabble's Jobs and Opportunities page or rabble.ca/journalismforchange. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on Rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.